I'm Steve Norman reporting. Leftist populist candidate Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador has been a significant lead to become Mexico's next president. His chief rivals, including the ruling PRI party, conceded defeat. Some fear Lopez Obrador will set the country back decades and lead to disaster with an interventionist economic policy. At the presidential candidates criticize President Trump's policies against migrants and against Mexico. VOA asked the director of the Wilson Center Mexico Institute, Duncan Wood, what kind of relationship the new Mexican president might have with Mr. Trump.
It all depends, I think. I mean, Andres Manuel has been very clear throughout his campaign that one of the most important priorities for him is to maintain a relationship of respect with the United States, that he understands that the economic relationship with the U.S., as well as the political relationship, is of fundamental importance to Mexico's prosperity and security.
Reports indicate voter turnout was high across Mexico in Sunday's election, in which voters also chose members of the legislature and other elective offices. A suicide car bomb aimed at a patrol of French soldiers killed 4 civilians in northern Mali. The suspected extremist attack is the third in 3 days. According to Mali's Ministry of Homeland Security, 31 were wounded, including 8 French soldiers. Jordan's prime minister visited a key crossing with Syria, inspecting aid deliveries by the Jordanian army to the tens of thousands of displaced Syrians gathering at the border Amman has kept sealed. Aid and rights groups have warned of a looming humanitarian crisis at the border as the displaced are unable to enter Jordan or to return to their homes. This is VOA News. U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says he believes most of North Korea's weapons of mass destruction can be dismantled within a year. His appearance on the CBS program Face the Nation took place amid media reports, citing U.S. intelligence as indicating Pyongyang had no intention of giving up its nuclear arsenal.
We're very well aware of North Korea's patterns of behavior over decades of negotiating with the United States. We know exactly what the risks are of them using negotiations to drag out the length of time they have to continue their nuclear, chemical, biological weapons programs and ballistic missiles. The president would like to see these discussions move promptly to get a resolution. This has been the advice that China's leader Xi Jinping has given us as well.
Bolton said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo would soon begin discussions with North Korean officials on details of disarmament. He expressed optimism North Korean leader Kim Jong-un could carry out his country's denuclearization. Abortion rights has emerged as a major topic of discussion among U.S. senators who will be voting on President Trump's eventual high court nominee to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is retiring by the end of the month. Minnesota Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar, appearing on the ABC program this week, says she's heartened by the views expressed by Republican women in the U.S. Senate.
Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski have shown time and time again that they're willing to buck their party when it comes to important issues like supporting the Affordable Care Act, defending Planned Parenthood, defending women's fundamental rights.
On his flight to New Jersey for the weekend, reporters asked President Trump who he's considering to replace Justice Kennedy.
I like them all. I think they're
five,
but I've got it down to about 5.
Senate Republicans promising a confirmation vote before the midterm elections in November. Police in Hong Kong stopped some 20 pro-democracy protesters from getting near a flag-raising ceremony marking the anniversary Sunday of the city's handover from Britain to China. Ao Nokin organized the protest.
This year, our slogan is end up one-party dictatorship, stop deterioration of Hong Kong. Why do we raise such slogan? It's because we can see there are a lot of problems from the Chinese government trying to impose unacceptable policies.
Hong Kong became part of China in 1997 after more than a century of British rule. China has made it clear it decides which policies are implemented in Hong Kong. Get more news at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, July the 2nd, and here are some of the stories we're covering. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has condemned an attack on a military patrol in northern Mali, which killed 4 civilians and wounded 31 others. And in Somalia, at least 5 civilians were killed and more than 10 others wounded after Al-Shabaab militants fired mortars in a residential area of the capital, Mogadishu. And this month and the past month of June, many African countries celebrate their independence. But as celebrations continue, many question what that independence actually means to the citizens of these countries.
First, the most important thing in independence is the independence economically. If you are not independent economically, you mean that is a problem.
That's a Burundian businessman speaking from the capital, Bujumbura, as the country celebrates its independence anniversary. And of late, Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province has been at the heart of a brewing crisis with what analysts say is an Islamist guerrilla movement and constant skirmishes between police and members of the Al-Sunna wa Jamaa. But many questions remain as to the goals of this militant group.
Community neglect, lack of development, ethnic tensions, and this is all just culminated into a situation manifesting at a level of about 32 independent cells executing attacks against civilians to instill fear.
Jasmine Opperman is a security and terrorism analyst based in South Africa. Those stories plus a story on the subculture of sports betting in Lagos and the World Cup update are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Four civilians were killed in an attack targeting a French patrol in Mali on Sunday. At least 20 other people were injured in the attack, including 8 French soldiers. The ambush in the northern town of Gao involved a car bomb explosion followed by gunfire. It took place 2 days after Islamist militants killed at least 6 people during a raid on a military headquarters in central Mali. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the attack and reiterated the determination of the United Nations to continue to support Malian officials in their efforts to stabilize the country. And in Somalia, at least 5 civilians were killed and more than 10 others wounded after Al-Shabaab militants fired mortars in a residential area of the capital, Mogadishu. Security spokesperson Abdelaziz Ali Ibrahim confirmed to VOA Somali service that the casualties were the results of a mortar attack. Security experts in Mogadishu told VOA Somali that 360mm mortars landed in a severe neighborhood in Wadajil district near the headquarters of the African Union mission in Somalia. The Al-Shabaab militant group claimed responsibility for the attack and said it targeted the AU forces headquarters. UN Deputy Special Representative for Somalia, Peter de Klerk, said that such attacks by Al-Shabaab were a desperate activity by the militant group. Meanwhile, the United Nations is warning Somaliland and Somalia's state of Puntland that further conflict in the disputed Tuareg area could result in a major humanitarian crisis. This weekend, ambassadors of the United States and France joined dozens of Ugandan demonstrators in the capital, Kampala, to protest against rising violence against women. There has been a number of unsolved murders and kidnappings in the country since early last year. The bodies of more than 20 women have been dumped on roadsides in Kampala. In a speech this month, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni accused some members of the security forces of working with criminals and announced measures including the collection of DNA from all Ugandans to help fight crime in the country. In a second meeting addressing the security situation in the country, opposition members of parliament asked President Museveni to let them be part of national security bodies. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
For the second time this month, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni held another security meeting with members of parliament, heads of security forces and other top government officials to discuss a way forward towards improving security in the country. Caps Hassan Fungaru, an opposition member of parliament, said after the meeting that the opposition MPs who attended the meeting asked the president to be considered towards improving security in the country.
Why is it that the leader of the opposition or the representative of the leader of the opposition, like the Shadow Minister of Defense or the Shadow Minister of Internal Affairs, are not included in meetings to do with national security matters? Why is it that when it comes to times of elections, NRM is fused with the police, with the army, with the intelligence services to defend the vote in favor of NRM?
Fungaru says both members of parliament from the opposition and the ruling National Resistance Movement Party live in fear after several prominent leaders in the country were murdered in recent days.
MPs are living in fear. Also, MPs reported, those who are given escorts by the system, by the president, in terms of police, that the police are running away. Police are saying, instead of escorting a member of parliament, he better go home. Because moving with a member of parliament, escorting a member of parliament, is a very big risk for them.
Fungaru says the president suggested providing extra security for the MPs. According to President Museveni's suggestion, MPs are to be given some escort cars as well as escort soldiers. Fungaru also says the president directed the Inspector General of Police to sack police officers that abandon MPs. Parliamentarian Mohamed Nsereko says he was glad the president invited MPs to give their views concerning national security.
The interaction is not bad. You get to know what those that you do not necessarily agree with think of you, but also think about the country. So matters of security, I think, should be given utmost priority for every single Ugandan.
But opposition member Semakola Tamaguzi, just like many members of the opposition, decided to boycott the meeting with the president.
We know that is one of the leading causes of the insecurity we have in this country, having removed both the age limit and the term limits. So we don't expect anything much from him.
Ruling party member of parliament Ibrahim Abiriga, one of the initiators of the removal of term limits from the constitution, was gunned down together with his bodyguard in Kampala earlier this month. It remains to be seen if the president's suggestion on improving security, which include regulation of social media, drones, gun fingerprints, and a ban on hoods for riders, will be put in place. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Violence has increased in the Cabo Delgado province in Mozambique, with at least 16 attacks and 49 people killed within the last 2 months. But many questions remain as to the group behind these attacks, known as Al-Sunna Wal Jamaa, and their ultimate goal. And for analysis, VOA's Harun Maruf spoke to Jasmine Opperman, a security and terrorism analyst based in South Africa.
Yes, I think it's a very complex matter. I just think the concern now, more than anything else, is the single narrative that is being attributed to the violence, namely that we are sitting with an Islamist insurgent, which there are no indicators or evidence of. We are sitting with a historical context of grievances, community neglect, lack of development, ethnic tensions. And this is all just culminated into a situation clearly manifesting at a level of about 32 independent cells executing attacks against civilians to instill fear. So it's a complex driving force. And to argue that it's Islamist insurgency is not taking into cognizance the reality of these attacks.
What do they want? What's the main drive? What's their target?
If this was an Islamist insurgent, there would have been a clear-cut doctrine, there would have been a clear-cut alternative, there would have been clear-cut structure with leaders stepping in and saying that we can offer a better option than what the Mozambican government is doing. But that is lacking. That is not present. Al-Shabaab or the Shabaab cult is not a group. It is a name being given by locals. And we need to understand how these communities, their culture and thinking. When people from Iraq arrives, example, they will say Iraqis. Or people from the Middle East, they will say, here's the Taliban. So, and this is what happened with Shabaab. people being seen as from that area has been referred by local communities as Shabab. And now everyone jumps to the conclusion there is a group called Shabab. There is no group called Shabab. What these cells want, I would love to know. What is clear is that they're instilling fear, that they are looting, that they are beheading, that there is extreme brutality. But what their objective is remains a debate, and it remains inconclusive.
How is the government defining them? What is the government saying?
The government at this point in time, two things. One, we are seeing, and this is a concern, and I'm not being critical, a government in denial. For them, this is a local issue that will have to be dealt with in a harsh manner by means of military response. So there's an overwhelming military approach now, and that is not going to solve the problem. There's a deeper rooted problem here, and we've seen it in many other places in the world that needs to be addressed. My concern is PMCs, my private military consultants, seeing the business opportunity, moving in, over-militarization. Russia and the US are now stepping in. A military solution will not solve this problem.
Is there a connection with a foreign group or militant group?
That there has been foreign influences. Initially, I'm going back to the Al-Sunna group. Most definitely. We must remember that this area has excessive movement of people. Pakistan, Bangladesh, Tanzania, Kenya, Somalia, you mention it. So those foreign influences coming into that area cannot be denied. Now, with the Sunna group, we have clearly seen that video propaganda material was propagated, and that at that point, this is what they grabbed onto. Not that there was an in-depth knowledge on extremists or an Islamist extremist interpretation, but that's not the issue. Low-hanging fruits, the way to go for these groups. But that a specific group, Shabab, never, they don't have an interest in this area.
That is Jasmine Opperman, the security and terrorism analyst based in South Africa. He was speaking to VOA Somali service reporter Haroon Maruf. This month and the past month of June, many African countries celebrated their independence. But as the celebrations continue, many question what that independence actually means to the citizens of these countries. In East Africa, Burundi celebrated 56 years since the country gained independence from Belgium. And reporter Moses Havyarimana is in the Burundian capital, Bujumbura, where he has this report.
Burundi claimed independence on 1st July 1962 and legally changed its name from Rwanda-Urundi to Burundi. The country became a constitutional monarchy with King Mwami Mwambutsa IV serving as the country's king. In 1959, Burundi's ruler Mwami Mwambutsa IV requested Burundi's independence from Belgium and the dissolution of the Rwanda-Urundi Union. UPRONA Party, led by Burundi independence hero Prince Louis Rwagasore, began to advocate for the end of Belgian colonial rule and the separation of Rwanda and Burundi. Burundi Vice President Gaston Sindimo is a member of the UPRONA Party.
After to kill Rwagasore, we have many crises. After 10 years, we have crises. After 10 years, we have crises. But now, we would like to stop those crises. We can do election without any supporting. But now we have some groups in opposition. They say that Burundian, we have crisis, we have genocide now. We show all peoples, all the world, that Burundian, we live in the peace.
Since 2015, when the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office, European Union, including Belgium, suspended direct aid to the Burundi government, which contributed almost 50% of the country's budget. Since then, the country's economic growth declined from 4.6% in 2014 to 1% in 2017 due to lack of foreign exchange. Ngendakumana Patrick is a businessman in Bujumbura.
If we try to see, the economy of the country is not in a good way, even if the security now, we can say that is a little bit good, but the most important thing in independence is the independence economically. If you are not independent economically, you mean that is a problem.
The Prona Party is more known to have played a great role in the country's independence, but since 2015, the political party was divided, with only one faction being recognized by the Burundi government. Tasia Simomana is a member of the faction which is not recognized by the Burundi government.
The small party cannot accept to be united with us because we have no longer the same vision. There is no vision of the development of our country.
The Burundi Vice President Gaso Sindimo believes that IPRONA party was never divided.
We have only one IPRONA, but there's some people who would like to use the name of IPRONA because they say that name is very powerful in the peoples. IPRONA is the party for independence, is the party for unity. IPRONA party is not the similar the other parties because we must conserve that independence.
As Burundi Today is celebrating the 56th Independence Day, opposition members say respecting human rights and democracy in the country is a major challenge for the current government. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Thank you, Moses. And even as the last African team exited the World Cup, there's still a lot of interest in the global tournament all over the African continent. In Nigeria, the love for football is ever present in all aspects of life, a factor that has fueled the growth of sports betting in the country. Reporter Samuel Okocha is in Lagos, Nigeria's commercial capital, and he looks at how the World Cup season affects this popular subculture.
Soccer fans gather here at this viewing center in Lagos to watch teams play at the ongoing World Cup in Russia. But this viewing center also doubles as a sports betting shop where I met Niyi Abdul Latif.
Every time of the league, I know how much I win. But now, I don't win anything.
Niyi has been betting for 7 years. He follows the major football leagues in Europe and says the league season offers more opportunities to make money. That's because during the league season, dozens of games are played on each match day. But that's not so in the season of the World Cup.
One we play 1 o'clock, another one we play 4 o'clock, another one we play 7 o'clock. Just 6 countries. That's 3 games a day. There's a difference there. During that time, we can choose 30 games a day. And the 30 games that we play the same day.
Meanwhile, surprises at this World Cup has also not helped matters for those who want to bet ahead of games.
Imagine Argentina to lose to Croatia, Argentina to draw with Iceland. Brazil cannot even win Switzerland. They're playing 1-1.
That's Jude, an operator of the small betting shop where Niyi and other young Nigerians also come to watch games from the ongoing World Cup. He says the high unpredictability of match results at the World Cup has made sports bettors to invest very little compared to what they put during the European League season.
If they come to bet in World Cup, they will say, oh, let me just put 100 naira, 500, 1,000. But in league, when people come, they will bring 50,000, 20,000, 100,000, 30,000 naira to bet. People put more money in league than this World Cup.
Nigerians' love for football has led to the growth of a sport betting culture that has over the years seen dozens of sports betting companies open shops in Nigeria. According to Valiant Moweta, a research analyst with Lagos-based investment banking firm AfriInvest, the popularity of European clubs, helped by increasing access to the internet, has contributed to grow the culture of sports betting in Nigeria.
We follow the Premier League as much as they do in Europe. You need to hear when people are analyzing some clubs and all. We are up to date on the latest news. So the fact that there is an increasing fan base and technology too, making information you need to make informed decisions about your bet or about sports very handy. those are the major drivers of the sports betting industry in Nigeria.
Meanwhile, sports bettors like Niyi can't wait for the league season to return to start making money.
We are waiting for the league. The league will start on August 11th. That's what we are waiting for now.
For VOA News, Samuel Okocha, Lagos, Nigeria.
And now for some World Cup news with Samson O'Malley. Good morning, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin with the latest update from the 2018 World Cup in Russia. The knockout stages of the 2018 FIFA World Cup took center stage on Saturday as France faced Argentina in the first match of the day at the Kazan Arena. Kylian Mbappe earned a penalty and scored two goals as France defeated Argentina 4-3 in a thrilling 2018 World Cup last-16 clash at the Kazan Arena. A three-goal salvo in the space of 11 second-half minutes saw Le Bleu come from behind to defeat the Albert Celeste and become the first team to ink their name in the quarterfinal lineup. In the second match of the day, Uruguay's Edinson Cavani scored two goals to help his side book a spot in the quarterfinals as he overpowered Portugal 2-1 in a highly anticipated match at the Feast Stadium. Those two results from the two matches on Saturday meant the world's biggest football stars, Lionel Messi of Argentina and Cristiano Ronaldo of Portugal, will not take further part in this year's tournament as the Uruguayan side faces France in the quarterfinals on Friday. And then on Sunday, Spain suffered a shock defeat to Russia in the 2018 FIFA World Cup at the Luzhniki Stadium in Moscow. Russia's Golden Eagles won 4-3 on penalties following a 1-1 stalemate, and they progressed into the quarterfinals while the Red Fury of Spain are eliminated from the tournament. In the late kickoff, Croatia overcame a stubborn Denmark side as the match ended in a 1-1 stalemate, and the Blazers advanced to the quarterfinals after winning 3-2 on penalties, while the Danish Dynamo bowed out of the competition. Russian goalkeeper Igor Akinfeev declined to take any credit for seeing his side through to the World Cup quarterfinals after beating Spain on penalties, insisting the hosts were just lucky. After the game ended 1-1 after 120 minutes, Akinfeev made two saves in the shootout, including a sensational stop with his trailing boot to deny Iago Aspers and seal Russia's spot in the quarterfinals. Now, Russia's Alexander Rekohin made the latest piece of World Cup history on Sunday when he became the first man to appear as a fourth substitute in a tournament match during the host game against Spain in Moscow. FIFA introduced a new regulation for the 2018 World Cup that allowed teams to use a fourth replacement in extra time, and coach Stanislav Checharazov took advantage of it halfway through the first period, sending on Yerohin for Dela Kozayev. Spain would also send on a fourth substitute with Rodrigo coming on for Marco Asensio. The game was level at 1-1 after 90 minutes and also at a point of a fourth change. In today's fixture, Mexico and Brazil will square each other up when they meet in the last 16 tie at the 2016 FIFA World Cup at the Samara Arena. In the second game, Belgium will face Spain. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in St. Petersburg, Moscow. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, July 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an in-depth discussion on the 31st African Union Summit underway in Mauritania. The 2018 theme is Winning the Fight Against Corruption, a Sustainable Path to Africa's Transformation.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.